The Diocese of Green Bay last week released the names of 46 priests who are known to have committed sexual offenses against minors, dating back to 1906. We're talking about clergy sexual abuse investigations here in Wisconsin and across the nation on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The diocese website says, quote, "It is important to note that inclusion on this list does not by itself mean that the accused priest has been found guilty of a crime or liable for any civil claim," unquote. But on Friday, Green Bay's police chief urged victims to take their stories to local law enforcement, not the church. Do you think Wisconsin should investigate how the Catholic Church has handled sex abuse complaints? What do you hope for if there is an investigation here in Wisconsin? Call in at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Peter Isley now. He is a founding member of Ending Clergy Abuse, as well as the organization Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. He's a survivor of childhood sexual assault by a Wisconsin priest. Peter, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
Well, Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm has called for a statewide investigation into the Catholic Church's response to reports of child sex abuse over the last half century. How likely do you think it is that this investigation would happen?
I think it's more likely now than it's ever been, and I think we're really hopeful of victims and survivors and our families in Wisconsin. There are now, I think, 15 states that have opened up investigations of sexual abuse by clergy in their state, and they're especially looking into the history of how church officials responded to these crimes, what they did with victims and reports that came to them. Of course, there's a very documented and established history about what we do know, that those were covered up, and the standard that has been set now is from the result of a two-year grand jury investigation in Pennsylvania that was released last summer. And the result of that investigation and their conclusions were damning and scathing and very detailed. That grand jury determined that thousands of children were sexually assaulted in that state, as they have been elsewhere. But most importantly, as they concluded, these crimes were covered up, including by current bishops and church officials, and that this cover-up, as they talked about it, was horrendous, was, in their words, sophisticated. It resulted in many children being hurt, and that reforms and steps have not been successfully made to end this conduct and this cover-up.
Peter, circling back here to Wisconsin, should there be concern about destruction of records, destruction of evidence?
There's absolute evidence, especially from the Green Bay Diocese, that they systematically destroyed almost all what appears to be their records and criminal evidence of abuse by clergy in that diocese in 2007. That was ordered by Bishop Zubik, who's now the Bishop of Pittsburgh, and he's under investigation, that diocese, right now by the Federal Department of Justice in Pennsylvania. And those admissions were made in court depositions under oath. And right now, the U.S. Department of Justice has every U.S. bishop in the United States under notice that they cannot, absolutely cannot, alter, destroy any files or records that they have. And the records that were destroyed in Green Bay were very specifically exactly the kinds of records and documents that we now know were destroyed in the Green Bay Diocese. And this, obviously this has to be investigated. And the diocese, in their release of names this week, made absolutely no mention about this. And that list that they released in Green Bay is not a complete list. We know at least of 16 offenders that have been investigated and identified by the priest as abusers in that diocese. These were Norbertine priests in particular. But those names are not on that list. And names also do not give you the information about what they did with these reports when they got them. So, you know, there's a lot that has to be looked into.
Talking with Peter Isley, founding member of Ending Clergy Abuse and the organization Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. Peter, how does U.S. bankruptcy court factor into these investigations and the process of justice for victims?
It's the story here is long and we can't get into it. But in Wisconsin, victims have not, part of the reasons why you haven't seen these priests that have done this prosecuted is because of two things. One, the statute of limitations, particularly in the past, into the 90s, and it's changed now, but the criminal statute was like 6 years for child sex assault. And so most victims take time to come forward. I mean, if you're assaulted when you were five and what you have until you're like 11 or 12 to somehow come forward, that's changed. But the old statute has allowed for many of these crimes not to be prosecuted. And what we see from, of course, church files and records is that the church deliberately did not report them. And when victims came forward, they were delayed in, you know, holding them out until that statute was gone. But what we do see is that civil cases, being able to file civil cases in court, that's what's brought all this information forward. Now, in Wisconsin, it's been impossible to file a civil case against the church for negligence, which is the usual cause of action that's used in these cases, because there was a decision by our Supreme Court in the 90s that no cases can be filed against a religious organization or a sexually abusive cleric and a supervisor that may have covered up for him and put him in a new parish or assignment, based on the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, that it interfered, doing that interfered with the practice of religion.
Well, let's pause right there and bring in Jerry from Lake Mills with thoughts. Jerry, go ahead.
I read a book some time ago now that indicated that the number of victims from these pedophiles is 250. Now, I know that a lot of these people are the children, and they are reluctant to confess to this, that they've been abused, but these are far, far, far too monstrous of crimes to be left in the hands of churches to sweep under the carpet and declare bankruptcy and wiggle their way out of this.
So, Peter, what does justice look like? Churches, archdioceses, dioceses, they want to keep these investigations local within the church.
Well, correct the caller, the number of victims is in the tens of thousands. Just the number of priests in the United States that have now been identified and acknowledged by the church itself who have committed these acts over the past few decades, and your next guest will talk about this, but is well over 7,000 right now, the 7,000 perpetrators. And so the number of victims are in the tens of, and probably well over 100,000 victims in the United States. So just to be clear, there's a lot of victims, and most victims don't come forward. I think the percentage is going to be under 10%. What needs to happen, of course, about this, with so many victims and so much involvement by the institution, very direct involvement of this, is that our Attorney General has the power and the capacity and the ability to be able to fully investigate, and it needs to be fully investigated, who's committed these crimes, whether individuals can still be prosecuted for these crimes, and again, you know, how the institution and the organization has systematically dealt with these crimes, covered up these crimes.
Peter, we have to leave it there. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Peter Isley is founding member of Ending Clergy Abuse, also founding member for Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. At the Green Bay Diocese last week, Bishop David Ricken released the names of 46 priests who are known to have committed sexual offenses against minors over the last 112 years. Here he is at a press conference with audio from the Green Bay Press Gazette.
The hurt they endured at the hands of their perpetrators cannot be undone. I can apologize, but more importantly, I need to show them through action that we are being open and addressing this issue head on.
Green Bay's Police Chief Andrew Smith on Friday called on victims to tell their stories to local law enforcement and not the church. What do you hope for if there is an investigation in Wisconsin? How do you feel about other investigations we've seen around the country in the past few years? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Terry McKiernan. He is founder and president of bishopaccountability.org. That's a clearinghouse for abuse data. Terry, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Great to be here, Kate. Thank you.
So investigations like the one the Milwaukee DA is calling for are happening all over the country. What have we seen with these investigations? How do they work? How do states get involved with the church?
The strongest example that we've seen recently is the grand jury investigation in Pennsylvania, and that really has changed the landscape. I don't think that the Green Bay bishop would have made the announcement that he did last week, but for the example of this huge report that came out in August of last year detailing what the church has been up to in six dioceses in Pennsylvania. Now, there have been other grand jury investigations, attorney general investigations elsewhere previously, but the Pennsylvania investigation really does set a new standard.
Pennsylvania is the only state that's completed its investigation, and they're still accepting tips. What happens when an investigation is over?
That's an excellent question, and unfortunately, the answer is a little bit depressing. Many of these investigations in the past have urged lawmakers to change what are known as statutes of limitations to allow people who were abused as children but whose cases are now, quote-unquote, too old under current statutes to get some sort of justice. And regularly these warnings from people who have spent sometimes years studying the problem in that state are ignored. So in Pennsylvania, it was absolutely clear as a result of the investigations that were done last year that the laws had to change. And yet, once again, the Catholic Church and other lobbying groups were able to prevent those changes from happening. So that's one area, I think, where we can hope that some of these, it may be something like 17 investigations that are now going forward, will result in actual legislative change in the states that are investigating.
Let's bring in a call now. Let's go to Winston joining us from Mineral Point. Winston, hi, what's on your mind?
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. This is a situation that people have been aware of for quite some time, and I can't understand why anything hasn't been done about it up until now. But I do understand that the church, Catholic Church, has handled this exemplary. They have done a near perfect job of covering this up for almost 100 years. And let's not forget, half of the population, and by that I mean the females in our country, will never be able to understand a man's passion. It's something that you have to experience.
So, Winston, how do you see justice playing out here?
I'm not sure. I've been on this planet for 60 years. I've seen a lot of changes. I'm not certain that in our particular political climate that any change is possible. We have police officers killing black people at random. We have a turmoil in this country that no one seems to be able to care about. Some people talk about it, but really it's mostly lip service.
Winston, let's pause there. Terry, your organization is called Bishop Accountability. Will the church ever be held accountable here?
I agree with Winston to some extent that it's a depressing track record that we see, and we don't really have reason yet to be very hopeful. One positive sign as a result of the Pennsylvania grand jury report is that we are getting, finally, lists of credibly accused priests coming out of the bishops' offices themselves, where all of the information, after all, resides. And so in the list that came out last week, there were many names on the list of priests who had abused children, and those names had never been known before. So this is a small step, but it's a significant step in the right direction. When you combine that fact with the investigations that are now going forward, I think we are finally going to learn more about the situation. With that information, will we be able to make the changes that are necessary? Will the bishops feel that they need to? Or will we lapse again into a period that we've seen again and again and again in this crisis, where there's attention devoted to it, some changes seem to be made, and then there's backsliding once again?
Looking at these databases that have come out, both locally here in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee, you can see the resume, so to speak, of where that priest has been in a community, in a parish. So that at least you can see where they have been. Is that helpful for victims to be able to see that? Because on the Milwaukee database, it said images on this page could really hurt you. And I'm paraphrasing here, but this can be some really difficult thing to look at.
I think it's a really good point, Kate. And I have heard both comments from survivors. A close survivor friend of mine has said that this past 6 months or so has been one of the most difficult that she's experienced in all of her time of being a survivor of this terrible thing that happened in her childhood. On the other hand, survivors often say to me that it is consoling and comforting in a terrible way, really, to know that a complaint was made to the Green Bay Diocese, for example, about a priest, and the Green Bay Diocese has finally admitted that that priest is accused. Very, very often, survivors in your communities have not come forward yet. And when they learn that someone else has come forward and that the diocese is actually acknowledging that, there's comfort there. And there's also opportunity for the survivor to come forward. And that coming forward is crucial in this matter, as the police chief that you quoted has said. Now we know the names of a lot of priests accused in Green Bay that we didn't know before. Well, attached to each of those names is, in many cases, a survivor, many survivors. And there's an opportunity now for survivors to do the very, very difficult work of coming forward and telling their stories.
Pope Francis has acknowledged to U.S. bishops that sexual abuse scandals have damaged the Catholic Church. How much of an influence has this had on clergy abuse investigations across the nation? What is the role of Pope Francis here?
The role of Pope Francis is really mixed, Kate. You know, he talks a good game. But when push comes to shove, we just learned in the last couple of days that a cleric in Argentina who was accused of serious offenses was actually sheltered by the Pope at the Vatican. I think the jury is out on this still, and there's a big meeting going to happen in Rome in February, and I hope that the Pope gets behind actual, real, significant change in the Catholic Church, but he has been dithering and weaving, and I don't think right at this very moment he's a force for real change in the situation.
So what will you be watching as investigations play out around the country and also here in Wisconsin?
Well, we certainly hope that the Attorney General in Wisconsin goes forward and takes this good advice that he's gotten. These investigations are sometimes very fruitful and sometimes not. I think we're going to see a real investigation, for example, in Illinois and in Michigan. That should generate a detailed report, as the investigation did in Pennsylvania. We hope that documents come out, because documents really show by how this has happened in a way that's very kind of vivid and impactful.
Terry, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Terry McKiernan is founder and president of bishopaccountability.org. That is a clearinghouse of abuse data. Up next, it's news. Then we take a look at the lawsuits happening in Wisconsin right now, brought by Republicans during the lame duck legislation and laws. And we look at their cost on taxpayers. I'm Kate Archer Kent. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're talking about litigation in the aftermath of the lame duck legislative session last month, in which Governor Scott Walker signed laws at the tail end of his tenure to curb the powers of incoming Democratic Governor Tony Evers and Attorney General Josh Call. A federal judge ruled last week that parts of the lame duck legislation passed by the legislature in December and signed by Governor Walker violate a court order issued in 2016. So lawsuits like this one will be costly, and Republicans are making plans to fend off the threats to these new laws. What do you think of the lame duck lawsuit challenges? Do you think lawmakers should be allowed to hire their own private attorneys? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Patrick Marley, who has been writing about this as politics and state house reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
So there are currently lawsuits related to Affordable Care Act, abortion access, legislation passed during the lame duck session. There's redistricting. There's Twitter. I mean, it seems like they're kind of coming from all directions. Can you sort out the big ones for us and help us make sense of the lawsuit traffic?
Sure. And Jason Stein, who used to work at the paper with me, used to joke that we've all become court reporters, those of us who cover politics. We've seen this for a number of years now. When Republicans controlled all of state government, they were passing laws that Democrats and those aligned with them didn't like. And we saw a lot of lawsuits over, say, voter ID, Act 10, the law that limited collective bargaining, right to work. And so we watched those all through the state and federal courts. Now we've got a little bit of a new dynamic with a Democratic governor and a Republican legislature. You had this lame duck legislation. So there are new types of lawsuits popping up. A big one was recently filed by Planned Parenthood over some longstanding abortion restrictions. The voter ID and early voting lawsuit continues. There was a recent ruling in that one because of some of the changes they made in the lame duck legislation. There's a brand new lawsuit over all of the lame duck legislation. There's this Twitter lawsuit. You've also got Lincoln Hills, the juvenile prison up north. That's got some lingering litigation happening there. So there's, you know, a dozen or more lawsuits that political reporters need to keep their eyes on.
A dozen or more lawsuits that political reporters need to keep an eye on. Well, Patrick, we're having a little bit of trouble with your connection, and we're going to switch to phone here because we really want to hear what you have to say as you guide us through these lawsuits. We're talking with Patrick Marley. He is a politics and state house reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think these lawsuits are necessary? Are you watching these lawsuits as they unfold? Which ones do you think have the most impact? 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. All right, Patrick, we're going to try this by phone now. Looking at the lame duck legislation and the suit against some of the lame duck legislation. What are the groups putting up these challenges, first of all?
So there's been two lawsuits that were filed. One, there was a lawsuit a number of years ago brought by One Wisconsin Institute and Citizen Action. Those are a couple of liberal advocacy groups over a number of election laws. They got a ruling in that case from a federal judge that said restrictions on early voting were unconstitutional and allowed local clerks to set as much early voting as they wanted. In response to that, as part of the lame duck legislation, Republicans put similar voting restrictions on early voting or limits on early voting that were quite like what they had passed before but had some differences. And so they said that early voting couldn't continue for more than 2 weeks. One Wisconsin and Citizen Action went back to the federal judge who issued the original decision and said, this is too much like what they did before. You found this is unconstitutional. We want you to enforce your injunction. And the judge recently said that they were correct, that those limits were unconstitutional, and blocked their enforcement. So that means that local governments can now, again, decide for themselves how much early voting they want to have. The underlying case was appealed years ago. It is sitting before an appeals court in Chicago. We don't know when the appeals court is going to rule, but obviously they could change the rules of the game once again.
Well, let's bring in a call now. Let's go to John in Manitowish Water. John, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing well. What's on your mind here as you look at these lawsuits?
Well, if you look at these people that are representing the public, they should have to be represented by public defenders, not private attorneys.
And why do you think that?
Well, because we voted them into public, and the chain of command puts public defenders in there, and I feel that they shouldn't get, you know, to hire these lawyers that are really good at their job, don't get me wrong, but will pull out every trick in the book to sway things their way. They should have to go through the same process as the regular public that can't offend or that can't hire an attorney and keep the state money for other items. So,
Patrick Marley, how aggressive will these attorneys be? And is there a merit to that going through the public defender route?
So it wouldn't be the public defender if it were paid by or if it was covered by state employees. It would be the Department of Justice. Typically what happens, somebody sues the legislature or sues the governor or a state agency or sued over a state law, it is the State Department of Justice overseen by the Attorney General that defends that law or defends that agency. And that's what would be happening in this case, in these cases, except that as part of the lame duck legislation, the legislators inserted language in there that allowed them to hire private attorneys at taxpayer expense if they wanted for these kinds of cases. This is in large part because they're suspicious of the new attorney general as a Democrat, and they're worried that he won't defend the law as fully as a Republican might. And so that's going to mean hiring these attorneys when the legislature decides to, and the taxpayers will have to pick up the bill. Meanwhile, the Department of Justice will also be involved in many of these cases, and so you'll have this situation where you've got DOJ in there arguing as well as attorneys specifically representing the legislature, you know, perhaps making the same arguments, perhaps making slightly different arguments. We'll have to see how well those defending the laws go along.
What do we know about the costs so far?
We don't know anything about the cost so far because they only recently have decided to hire their first law firm in one of these lawsuits that was filed in Dane County Circuit Court. We don't even know what that law firm's going to be, and we don't know how they're going to structure those bills. But if you look at, in the past, Governor Walker typically hired attorneys that were paid $175 an hour to defend the state when there were conflicts that prevented the Department of Justice from representing the state. The legislature has long had attorneys in the redistricting case. They've had a couple of sets of attorneys, but one group of attorneys they've had are paid about $300 an hour.
We had both Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Assembly Minority Leader Gordon Hintze on the program yesterday, and want to take a listen to both of them as they look their view on these suits, and here is Representative Hintz's take on the suits.
When you write hasty decision, you know, laws and bad public policy, that it very often does end up in the court.
So is this argument you heard from Democrats about the lame duck suits that it was too fast to get it right?
Well, I mentioned before the early voting lawsuit. The other one that was filed is maintaining that all the lame duck legislation has to be thrown out because of the way the legislature convened themselves. They held what's called an extraordinary session, which essentially means that lawmakers call themselves onto the floor at a time where they weren't otherwise scheduled to be on the floor. Those suing say there's nothing in state law or the Constitution that allows that kind of session, and so everything is invalid. The legislature's been holding those kinds of sessions for decades. The nonpartisan attorneys for the legislature, they're sort of separate on-staff attorneys, say that everything is okay and there's no legal flaw here. You know, it's going to be up to a judge to decide. But that doesn't, I mean, the basis of that lawsuit is not necessarily that it was too hastily done. It's just that they say that the mechanism they used to pass it was inappropriate.
Let's listen to Representative Voss now and his take on the suits over the lame duck legislation.
I guess we'd have to figure out why all these liberal interest groups are suing to somehow say that constitutionally passed laws are unconstitutional.
So what should we take from that? That, you know, Voss is saying here, we went through all of the right channels and now liberal interest groups are suing us for doing this.
Well, this is nothing new in terms of lawsuits over laws that are controversial. I mean, you've got it. It happens both on the left and the right. You know, there's been a lot of lawsuits over Obamacare, and there's been a lot of lawsuits over Act 10. There's been a lot of lawsuits over voter ID in Wisconsin and in other states. You know, the things that inflame our politics also wind up getting settled in court, or at least continue to be argued about in court, because these are the things people feel most passionately about.
We're talking with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's politics and State House reporter Patrick Marley about the potential costs that could mount as challenges to lame duck session legislation are filed in court. We talked with Assembly Speaker Robin Voss yesterday about these suits, in particular the ruling last week that struck down restrictions on early voting. He called the decision disappointing and pointed out some states don't offer any early voting opportunities. So what do you think about these challenges? What are you watching for? And what about these suits interests you? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll get back to the conversation in just a minute right here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the latest litigation challenging the lame duck session laws and a new suit about First Amendment rights. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who was on the program yesterday, talked about another federal ruling from last week that found he and other Republican lawmakers violated the First Amendment rights of a liberal advocacy group when they blocked the organization on Twitter. Voss said the decision raises privacy concerns. We're talking about it on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What do you make of these lawsuits? Which suits are you paying attention to and why? What litigation do you have questions about? Join in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's State House reporter Patrick Marley is our guide. He's been reporting on the mounting legal challenges and their potential costs. Patrick, looking at this issue over First Amendment rights, this suit about Twitter, help us understand what's behind this.
Sure. So One Wisconsin Now, again, which is a liberal advocacy group, is very active on Twitter. They follow all the Republican lawmakers, probably some Democratic lawmakers. And Speaker Voss Representative John Nygren, who's the co-chairman of the Budget Committee, and Representative Jesse Kramer, who recently left office, had all blocked One Wisconsin Now. One Wisconsin Now filed a federal lawsuit saying that violated their First Amendment rights because the group said they couldn't interact, they couldn't see what Voss and the others were doing on Twitter, what kind of policy issues they were talking about. They couldn't offer a countering point of view to tell voters why they think those policies are not good. And a federal judge last week sided with them and said that these are essentially official extensions of these lawmakers' offices, and they cannot block people simply because they don't like their points of view. And so he said that this had violated their First Amendment rights. He actually hasn't settled on what the resolution is going to be, but has indicated that likely the way to do it is to make the lawmakers unblock One Wisconsin Now.
And Voss said the decision raises privacy concerns because Speaker Voss has two different Twitter accounts, one for being Speaker and the other his regular account. Does he have a point here about privacy concerns?
He's got two Twitter accounts. One is called at Speaker Voss. One is called at Rep Voss. He blocked One Wisconsin Now, which is at Rep Voss account. The court indicated, viewed those both as official accounts. The group did not sue over the Speaker Voss account because it wasn't blocked on that channel. I think it's really not fully explored in this case. Because the judge found that all of the accounts in question were official accounts, this issue of privacy didn't really come up because they're considered official pronouncements of the public officials. Many lawmakers have two accounts, sort of a campaign account and an official account. We haven't seen litigation over what would be considered a campaign account.
So Wisconsin is currently part of a lawsuit with 19 other states that led to a federal judge invalidating the Affordable Care Act last month. The ACA will stay in place while that decision is appealed. But we've seen Governor Evers, who's campaigned on not being part of that suit, but lame duck legislation made it difficult for Wisconsin to get out of that suit. Where are we on this?
Yeah, that's right. Evers, one of his chief campaign promises was to get Wisconsin out of that lawsuit. The lame duck legislation, the lawmakers said that litigation like that would be overseen by the legislature rather than the governor. And so they've made it so that Evers can't be the one to determine whether we stay in or get out. And so far, lawmakers are keeping us in the case. Evers has indicated what he's going to try to do is get Josh Call, the attorney general, who's a Democrat and agrees with Evers on these issues, to basically switch sides in the case to say that rather than being in the lawsuit to bring down Obamacare, they will switch with a number of states that intervened and join with them to argue that the Affordable Care Act should be kept in place. We haven't seen those actual court documents that would do that, but Evers has indicated that's what he very well may do.
Let's bring in another call now. Let's go to Nate joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Nate. What's on your mind?
I've been following the gerrymandering court case because gerrymandering prevents the citizens of Wisconsin from having honest elections. And as another stab at the citizens, the Republicans in the state legislature have charged us close to $3 million now to basically defend the ability to prevent honest elections.
Nate, thanks for the call. Patrick Marley, where are we at on the gerrymandering case? Bring us up to speed on that case.
So Wisconsin's case went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court found that those who sued didn't have legal standing to bring their case, kind of provided them a roadmap as to how they could establish legal standing. The suit has been adjusted, they say, to address those standing concerns, and it's set to go to trial here in April. In the meantime, Republican lawmakers have asked for the case to be put on hold while the U.S. Supreme Court considers cases from a couple of other states. They're going to hear arguments this spring and render a decision by this summer. And the Republican lawmakers here say there's no point in our trial proceeding until we know what the U.S. Supreme Court precedent is going to be on these types of cases. In the meantime, they do have private attorneys in these cases. Recently reached an agreement for $850,000 for private attorneys to defend the maps through this trial. There has been some past expenses, that estimate of about $3 million, if you take into account some prior litigation, sounds about right to me.
Well, Patrick, now that you've turned into a courts reporter, do you have any predictions as to how these cases that we're watching might go, how they will end up in court?
I don't. I try to, you never really know what's going to happen in the courts. I'd say, you look back to the way John Roberts ruled in the Obamacare case. I think that took a lot of the public by surprise. So I don't think you can necessarily say because a Democrat appointed a judge or a Republican appointed a judge that you know how that judge is going to rule. There are a lot of surprises along the way. The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, which is a federal court in Chicago that hears federal litigation from Wisconsin. You never really know what kind of panel that they're going to get, which three judges are going to wind up there. So generally not a good idea to make guesses in these kinds of things and just to keep an eye on what they actually do.
Patrick, how easy will it be to track the money as these lawsuits progress and what lawmakers are spending on representation, on spending on litigation? Because yesterday, Speaker Voss told us that the $850,000 contract that Republicans had with a law firm to defend legal challenges had been released, but that wasn't immediately clear. So what about transparency here?
So any actual payments that are made should be available to the public. We've gotten, for instance, the redistricting invoices and are able to review those. In the past, both the legislature and the executive branch has released its contracts with law firms so you can see what the hourly rates are, whatever other pay structure they might have for these attorneys. With this latest contract between the legislature, or actually between the state assembly and a law firm, it's unusual for two reasons. One, they did a different kind of price structure. Instead of having an hourly rate, they just have a flat fee to take them through trial, which is $850,000. The more unusual part of it is that the assembly would not release that contract as they've released contracts in the past. Speaker Voss said that he viewed that as attorney-client privileged content and that he would not make it available. On Friday, he said his office sent me an email saying that they wouldn't make that available. And he said on your radio program yesterday that that it had been made public. It actually hasn't been released yet. They've just said they're going to release it, and we expect to see it before too long.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Patrick Marley is a politics and state house reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Just ahead, in recent years, so-called memory cafes have emerged and spread across the country, offering social experiences and support for individuals and families affected by dementia. We'll hear about memory cafes in Wisconsin, including a new art-focused cafe that recently launched in Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.